Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast, Kermode and Mayo's Film Review. To find other programmes you might be interested in, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
Hello and welcome to another podcast. As a listener and subscriber to this podcast, we do think that you are amongst the elite, do we not?
We do. We think that you are the top 5% of the country's listening public.
Well, in fact, it's not just the country. It's not just the UK from which we emanate. It is around the world where people are downloading this podcast.
Because here on Battleship Wittertainment, we are the BBC's flagship.
That's what people tell us.
It is, apparently.
Anyway, and these are the kind of the extra bits which people who just listen to the live radio show don't actually get.
No, I know. It's always better to podcast, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. I'm not quite sure about
that. Do both.
Do both, indeed. Then you can treasure it and keep it forever. On the show today, our guests include
Leslie Manville, who will be talking about the new Mike Leigh film, Another Year, which is coming out in a few weeks' time and is, in my opinion, one of his best.
Ridian Brooke, who is the writer of Africa United, which is an African road movie.
There will be a brief appearance by Stephen Angry Woolley.
He's very angry.
He is very angry and very persistent.
And it's kind of about on the same subject that he was angry about when we spoke to him last time.
But I think justifiably angry
this time. Is
that
right?
Well, I believe so.
People will be making up their own
minds.
Anyway, without further ado, because the show's long enough anyway.
And there will also be reviews of Paranormal Activity 2, Mary and Max, Easy A, and other things.
Throw another log on the fire and enjoy the latest Wittertainment episode. I know I shall. There are all kinds of reasons for missing what we do. Here's one from Darren. Dear Earth and Quake, 7 weeks ago, Christchurch, New Zealand was hit by a 7.1 magnitude earthquake, and since then we've had over 2,500 aftershocks. Clearing up after the mess, after the original quake, has meant that I've got behind listening to your podcast. Now, as excuses go,
that's one of the better ones.
This seems to me to be the best that we've ever heard. Sorry, I've missed the show. I've been clearing up after a 7.1 magnitude earthquake with 2,500 aftershocks.
That is astonishing. That's the kind of excuse we need. I mean, not just I was busy or I had to go and do the shopping.
I tend to listen, says Darren, whilst preparing dinner or cleaning up afterwards, as listening to the good doctor's rants make me realise that it is possible to be paid to be grumpy and gives me a goal in life as I inevitably head towards the grumpy old man status that some have already attained. It was whilst listening to one such rant that the ground started to move with yet another aftershock. This merely added to the... Imagine listening to one of your rants during an earthquake. The intensity of the rant intensified the intensity... added to the intensity of the rant. In fact, if I'd been able to watch it live streaming, unlikely as that would be 3 o'clock in the morning and I'd rather be asleep, no offence, I think the whole scene would have been just too much. The audio rant, the ground shaking and watching those hands flap around would have been a 4D extravaganza to behold.
On the subject of getting towards grumpy old age, there was a discussion on Twitter recently about when did I stop dyeing my hair? Mm-hmm. Can I just say for the record, I've never dyed my hair. I'm just going grey quite suddenly. But... although quite profoundly, I am aiming towards Nick Lowe. That's what I'm aiming towards, the Nick Lowe completely white quiff. I think that would look classy.
Well, he does look classy.
He looks fantastic, doesn't he? He's demonstrated of just how great a really grey quiff looks.
Stephen Tyler in Los Angeles. I've been listening to your podcast film reviews on and off for several years. I've just had an opportunity to see a YouTube video of one of your reviews. Dr. Kermode and Mr. May, you are not as I had pictured in my mind's eye.
Really? He had more hair in his mind's eye.
It had always been my mind's vision that Dr. Kermode was taller and leaner than in actuality.
Is he calling me short and fat?
Mr. Mayo is quite younger than I had pictured. I had always visioned him as a septuagenarian with a white moustache and a cashmere sweater.
Right. So the reason that you read that email out is because he thinks that in real life I'm shorter and fatter than he imagined and you're younger.
Yeah, but I sound...
thanks. It doesn't matter what you sound like.
I sound like a 70-year-old.
Yeah, but you look like a child, apparently.
Thank you. A quickie here from Zach Jacobson.
You've got to stop dyeing your hair.
Upon return from my honeymoon, not long ago, I received a phone call from a dear friend demanding to know whether I'd listened to the podcast yet. Whilst I was quick to download it as soon as the plane had landed, I'd yet to actually listen to the podcast, which I was eagerly anticipating, as the guest was Aaron Sorkin, of whom I'm a big fan. This friend then proceeded to play me a clip of the podcast over the phone. Tears welled up in my eyes a little as the entire Phoenix Theatre in London proceeded to say hello to me, Zach Jacobson, and my new lovely wife.
Right.
Easily the best wedding present I could ever have gotten, says Zach Jacobson, another Kiwi listener. He's wondering how he can top this whole experience. And this is what he is genuinely going to try to do.
Okay.
He was the one who said hello to Jason Isaacs in his wedding speech.
That's right, yes.
You'll remember.
And other people are attempting to work hello to Jason Isaacs into
all kinds of things.
High-profile events.
Zach Jacobson says the only thing he can think to top this is that they're going to call their firstborn son Jason Isaacs Jacobson.
That's good. That's very good.
Can anybody top, first of all, the excuse of missing a podcast because there's an earthquake? Or two, naming your devotion to the program is such that you're prepared to name your child Jason Isaacs, and then
is Jason Isaacs the first, or is it Jason Isaacs Jason? I mean, would it be his name is Jason Jacobson? Because Jason Jacobson sounds like he ought to be running a private detective agency. Don't you think?
Yeah, but that's okay.
Jason Jacobson, PI.
Anyway, Jason Isaacs Jacobson, thank you very much indeed for all the contributions to our code of conduct. To say it's up and running.
To understate the wheelbarrow.
There are so many suggestions. What we're going to do is we'll collate them over the next couple of weeks and we will come up with the definitive code to behaviour in a cinema. Johnny H. contributes, no more than two teenagers seated together at any time. Parents may not be allowed to accompany children unless they have an interest in the film themselves. No visits to the toilet during the screening. If you can't hold your bladder for 2 hours, too bad. No exit from the screening to buy more food. Once the film starts, you stay in the seat unless there's a fire or emergency. I guess we could say, or earthquake.
Yeah.
For our New Zealand listeners. No narration or commentary allowed during the screening. Watch the film and shut up. If you like 10, if you like the seats during screening, you agree. Oh, if you kick the seats during screening, you agree to have your legs strapped to the chair. Likewise, if you talk during the screening, you must wear a muzzle.
Very good. The only one that's difficult there is the not going to the toilet, because, as I've said before, famously, Jack Warner, who used to run Warner Brothers, used to judge how saleable a picture was by how many times he had to go to the loo whilst watching it. And he famously said of Bonnie and Clyde, and I'm paraphrasing slightly, that film is a 3P picture.
Very good.
Yeah.
No children in PGs who haven't learned to sit still and be quiet. No gang of lads who feel obliged to guffaw in unison. No gang of lads clustered in multiple rows, linear seating only. No eating as if you haven't eaten for a week. This is a really rigged big picture. Yeah. Not just having a snack during a film, but people who scoff as though they've starved themselves for 7 days. And remember, your head is not transparent before you choose a seat.
It is weird, the taking in the huge amount of food. Jason Miller told me that, sorry to mention it so early on, but when The Exorcist was playing in New York, one of the things that happened was that entire families would turn up with picnics, and he described entire families sitting there with picnics to two or three screenings of The Exorcist. You know, egg roll, anyone?
Okay, so we're going to collate all of those in a very kind of handy format, but they're all coming in, and we'll certainly work out our favourites, and it will be, so we'll put them down as like the ten commandments, really. Mm-hmm. I think is probably the best way of doing it. Now, you might have heard some titters off, and if you're watching us being live streamed, you'll wonder who the attractive man in the green African themed shirt is. Well, that is Ridian Brooke, who has written the movie Africa United, which you might have seen advertised on a bus passing
on the side of every bus in
Hello,
London.
Ridian.
They
Hello.
Certainly didn't skimp on the advertising campaign, did they?
They didn't hold back.
It's very good to have you on the programme.
Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Spectacular shirt. I do like that very much.
It's a good radio shirt.
Tell us about Africa United.
Can I say we have a clip of Africa United? No, hold on, wait. I'm just going to say that pretty much sets up the plot, so just in order to not to...
Why don't you handle this bit, Mark?
No, you handle it. I'm just saying there is a clip. Would you like... You can set up the basic room, but there is a very nice clip that sets up the plot. Carry on.
But he probably doesn't know what's in the clip. What's in the clip?
It's the bit when the guy says, can you do that? You know, how would you like to join the team? It's the explanatory clip.
Tee it up then, Ridian.
Africa United is out today. It's the story of five kids who walk 3,000 miles to get to the opening ceremony of the World Cup from Rwanda to Soccer City in Johannesburg. And it's kind of about what happens on the way as much as it is about getting there.
That's as good a tee-up as I think it's possible to do.
Should we have a clip?
Here's the clip.
Hey!
Why didn't you carry on?
Didn't you see? I got the record.
You think Ronaldo would be satisfied with 502? Why only break the record? Yet you could smash it and mash it!
You're worse than my mother.
Do you think you can do that again with the real football?
It's easier with the real football.
Jean-Baptiste, I'm working with FIFA. Do you know FIFA?
Yeah.
You think we're monkeys?
Beat it, kid. Am I talking to you?
You talk to him. You talk to me. I'm his manager.
Do you know of the trial in Kigali Stadium tomorrow?
Sure.
FIFA is looking for young African footballers to represent their countries at the opening ceremony of the World Cup. And I tell you, you have a very, very good chance of being selected. The trial is tomorrow, National Stadium in Kigali. In 1 month, you'll be at the World Cup.
World Cup.
Do you need money for the bus?
Yeah, we do.
Okay. Don't be late. I want you in the team for the dream. Africa United.
And while that clip was playing... Yeah. There's Mr. Screw again. Bad clip. That's what's wrong. That's the authorised explanatory clip.
Yeah, no, it's fine. It's fine. It doesn't.
I'm glad it's fine. The clip from your movie that you wrote.
It's not my favourite bit, but it's fine as a clip.
What was wrong with that clip?
It was fine.
Not that we've taken that personally in any way.
It was absolutely fine. As you say, it sort of gives the setup.
Tell us where you found these kids.
Well, the kids came from five different countries, I think, in the end. Uganda, Rwanda, they looked in Kenya, and two actually from England, but first generation Rwandan. Roger, who plays for Brice, very last minute, 6 weeks before the shoot, was found in Norwich. They needed someone who was A, African, B, could speak English well, C, was very good at football, and he was in Norwich.
I have a bone to pick with you before we get into the nuts and bolts of the film. Why is there an Arsenal shirt so dominant throughout the film, which I personally found quite disturbing offensive and off-putting?
Well, the main character is Dudu, and he is the voice and spirit of the film.
Yeah, but why does he have to be an Arsenal supporter?
He's wearing an Arsenal kit. It just felt right that he
was.
Who
do you support, Ridian?
Actually, I support Bolton Wanderers.
Well, why isn't he wearing a Bolton Wanderers kit? That would have been more evocative.
Well, actually, there is quite a good reason, which is if you go to Rwanda, you'll probably see more Arsenal shirts than any other club.
Well, make him from Norwich, then. He could wear a Norwich City shirt. So, now explain, because it is a road movie. It is, I think people will have got from that clip that it's quite jaunty, it's certainly very funny, and the relationship between the kids is great and something to behold. But you do not skimp on some of the tougher themes and tougher messages which kids face if they're going to be walking through Africa.
Yeah, when we were discussing this idea, and it's like a one-line premise about, let's see, 18 months ago now, we thought, well, yes, this is a great setup and it's a great storyline, but if we're going to make this, we can't avoid some of the issues that are going to be there. And if you've spent time in Africa, as I have, as have the other filmmakers, then it would be kind of somehow patronising not to. The balance was, how do you do that?
Mm.
And so that was the tightrope we felt we had to walk. We wanted it to be entertaining. We wanted it to be enjoyable. You know, there are a lot of incredibly funny people I've met out there, and I wanted to sort of kind of give a voice to that, and Dudu was kind of the voice for that.
Yeah, so we're talking AIDS, we're talking about child soldiers, and so these are themes which are all part of their road journey.
Yes, I mean, again, there was a danger we were going to tick boxes with each of the characters, but it felt, we have a middle-class kid, Fabrice. A lot of people don't even realise there's a middle-class in some African countries. So that seemed right from the off. And Dudu, it was very clear to me that Dudu should be an orphan, and that there was a kind of, there was a background there which involved AIDS with his parents being missing, and that kind of was informed perhaps by an earlier journey I made 4 or 5 years ago with my own family. So there were things that I wanted to say, but I felt the only way you could say it legitimately would be through good characters you cared about and loved enough to follow, and through humour. And it's not often that you know, those things go together, but they do go together.
We discussed on this programme when Slumdog Millionaire came out, how it was marketed on the side of buses, because...
It's a feel-good film.
Well, yes, and I think the quote that they found from someone was the
feel-good film of the decade, which was kind of hard to imagine the scenes of the children being horribly abused in the back streets of Mumbai. It was a strange quote.
And some people have... I mean, on the one hand, it's a great compliment if there's, you know, it's the Slumdog film of the year in that same kind of category, which kind of helps you enormously because of all the accolades that went with that fantastic film, while on the other hand not helping at all.
Yeah, look, when we discussed this idea, I'm not even sure that Slumdog was in the ether, at least in our thinking, but by the time I'd written the script, Slumdog was out there. So it created an atmosphere, if you like, an environment where a film that was set in, you know, another country involving kids and some hardship could still get people going to cinemas. I think it's become a byword for a film that people want to see. So that's great. The danger is that people have that expectation of it being something that's, you know, really slick, you know, incredibly well done and all of those things. Not that ours isn't, but it is a different film. And you want it's saying and doing different things in a different way. It's also, I think, it's more of a family film. It's not that, you know, when I wrote it, I wasn't actually consciously thinking I'm writing a family film. I knew that it was going to be, kids were going to be the voice, therefore it was a film that families could go and see. And from my own experience, I felt some of the issues that are in that film are issues that kids can engage with and should engage with, as my own children did when I did the journey.
Well, I want
to
ask you about that. I want to ask you about that in just a moment. But when you call it a family film, that kind of, and this taps into a previous conversation that we've had about the 12 certificate, which is what you've got here. It's a family
12A.
Film. 12A.
Yeah, but all 12 is 12A.
So what you have is a family film about kids with AIDS, HIV. Child soldiers and quite a bit of
cussing. Prostitution. And I mean the most difficult subjects, you know, to deal with.
Yes, but I think they are there, and I think they're right. I think they're rightly there. It just wouldn't have been. I don't think we'd have any integrity if we hadn't found a way to weave those in to the story. And in fact, you know, in the case of Dudu, you know, it's in the DNA of his, you know, of his, who he is and why actually he's making the journey. I don't want to give that away, but that was the very first Dudu situation, and the deeper things that he's facing that was the first thing I got right from the beginning when I was writing the story. So it just felt right. It's interesting because when you write a script, I wasn't consciously thinking which demographic and age group is this for. That's something that happens later, and the marketing and all these things take over. And they're trying to find who is the audience for this. And I think, you know, when we made it, we were conscious that it was a film, certainly a film that I wanted my 10-year-old daughter to be able to see, but I, you know, wanted my mum and my dad to go and enjoy it too. And I think it does fit that.
But what's interesting is that right from the very beginning, when the film opens with, you know, a young child giving this safe sex lecture about using condoms, and then he very cleverly turns a condom into a football whilst he's explaining, you see that he's actually, you know, in the process of explaining this to other people. And so it's like at the very beginning, you set your stall out. We're going to talk about these subjects, but we're going to talk about them in a way which is very, very sort of young friendly, which is, you know, totally unabashed. And actually, looking at the BBFC report, which is quite extensive, as always, they've acknowledged everything that's in it. But what they've also acknowledged is that it's all done in a manner which does not, therefore, disclude the audience. I have to say, I'm impressed that you've got a 12A certificate. I think it would have been a great loss for it to be a 15. But I think it really could easily have been a 15, just considering, I mean, when you're talking about subjects of child soldiery, you think recently, look at movies like Johnny Mad Dog, which were dealing with similar stuff. I mean, it's a really appallingly tough subject. And the fact that you've managed to get that into a 12A certificate movie, I think is great credit to you.
Yeah, I think it isn't an issues-driven movie. I think it was essentially a character-driven movie. I think that's why it works at that level. I think because it's humorous. It's full of adventure. There's lots of action. It wasn't being driven by any of those issues. They're all there, and they're all important. And I think need to be acknowledged, but I think they add something to it. I mean, obviously, within the film, there's a cartoon within the film,
yeah,
which we call Dudu Vision, and that was again from the beginning. I wanted Dudu to be able to tell a story within the story, and the thinking there was partly that he would be able to articulate some of the things he couldn't articulate in the film. And there was a bit of resistance at first to us having a cartoon within it. And,
but the animated sequences are really, actually, a few people have mentioned how much they stand out. They are, but they're very bright and vibrant and bring you in and, you know, and remind you the tone of the film.
Yeah, and they're sort of, they actually, in a way, slow it down as well. And it has a different pace because it's very snappy and fast and punchy, and all of that's good, and there's a high energy to it, but the Dudu Vision sort of slightly slows it down, just shows you another world, shows you some of the sort of almost like the subliminal things that are going on in Dudu's head that he can't express.
How much of this film came out? You mentioned a couple of times your experiences in Africa, and a few years, if I've remembered this right, a few years ago, you took your kids out of school, didn't you, to go to Africa?
Shock horror. Yes, I was asked to write a book about AIDS for the Salvation Army and their response to AIDS around the world. and I did a 9-month trip, and the only way you could do it was to live in communities that were actually affected by it. And that was absolutely, utterly sort of seminal in terms of...
So how old were your kids at that time?
They were 9 and 6. Gabriel was 9 and Agnes was 6. And it was an incredible journey. And one of the things I was asked, one of the things I was asked to do on that journey was go and find stories of hope and transformation in the midst of the pandemic, because actually that's where the best stories are to be found. And they were there. And actually one of the striking things about that whole experience, and we did see some tough things and lived in some tough places, was actually how much more, you know, we laughed a lot more than we cried. We did cry, but there was a lot of laughter. There was a lot of, you know, great friendships made and a lot of joy. And some of the things, you know, if you drive through Africa in a Jeep and you cannot not but notice the children in a way, it absolutely leapt out at us. And that was a constant on the journey. And I thought there's got to be, you know, who's giving a voice to those children? I don't know. But it was incredibly striking on that journey.
So are you, I mean, maybe it was just subliminal almost, but are the characters that we see in your film sort of composite kids based on some of the characters that you met then?
I think a couple of them are. I did another road trip last year with Debs, the director, and Bernie, who did the music, and one of the directors called Ayub from Rwanda, and we actually mapped out the whole journey that he did in two stages. And on that journey, we met a couple of child soldiers, one of whom I kind of based Foreman George on. Junu came really from my own obsession with Huckleberry Finn, and he was a bit of a, you know, he's a cross between Huck Finn, Walter Mitty, and Mrs. Malaprop, really, you know, muddling up all. You do encounter a lot of NGO speak when you're out there, and you get, you know, you do get these educational films, and a lot of by rote kind of learning. So I wanted to mash all that up into Dudu, because one, you know, some people have said it feels a bit like a UN, thing lesson at the beginning, which is precisely what it is, and you encounter a lot of that. So definitely. If I hadn't done that journey and hadn't done the road journeys, I don't think I could have.
But there's gone. I was going to say, but it's also a return. I mean, one of the things that I complain about a lot is that what used to be the family film has disappeared with the segmentation of the audience, which is this is a kids' film, this is a teenage film, this is a teenage boys' film, this is a teenage girls' film, this is an adult film. Actually, the great kids' films of the past are movies like Cares, which would deal with difficult subjects, but would be a youth certificate film that anybody could go and see. And actually, a film like Africa United is in that tradition of making a film that is not aimed at a single section of the market, but at a time in which those films are horribly scarce.
They are scarce, and I think that's why it's, you know, it's very timely that this film's out, because I think I think some people are slightly thrown because you want to put it in a pigeonhole and you want to say it is this and it isn't that, and it slightly breaks a few of those rules, I think. And you know, you go to a lot of screenings in the build-up, and there have been a lot of children and a lot of adults in it, and the response, you know, you're getting a great response from both. Mm-hmm. There's not a marked difference.
So people should just bear in mind, exactly as Mark said, it's a 12A for a reason.
Yes.
You know, it's not a PG.
It's a 12A for a reason, but yes. I mean, I would say 8 or 9 is about as young as you.
Well, the way the BBFC worked generally is what they almost had a mandatory no lower than 8 for 12A. So what the 12A generally means is below 8, forget it, you are making it up.
Yes.
But beyond that, you know, obviously take your children, but be under advisement that there are subjects that are difficult that you may need to talk to them about, which is one of the things that they are sort of, you know, very in favour of.
You're going to have different levels of conversation when you come out of the cinema with an 8-year-old who might have missed all the condom stuff, but you might have a conversation about child soldiers. You know, with the 12-year-old, you might have a conversation. Do you know what I mean? The conversation's going to be different.
And Comic Relief branding is on the poster. What's that got to do with the film?
Well, they're giving 25%. Pathiv and the filmmakers have agreed to give 25% of the profits of the film to Comic Relief, which is actually a huge amount of money potentially. If it did a Slumdog, that's an awful lot of money to go to Comic Relief and some of the issues that are raised in the film. So I think that's pretty amazing, actually. And you know, if it does evenly reasonably well, that will be fantastic.
A couple of queries here, John, on this email. I saw Africa United last Sunday at the premiere. I went as my sister was associate caster. That's how I got the tickets. I was sat behind most of Ridian's extended family. How many do you have? I enjoyed the movie very much. I wondered if did you consider having any part of the film in one of the two local languages mostly spoken in Rwanda rather than English?
Yes, we did. And it was dismissed quite quickly. But we, because the kids actually all come from different countries, they would have probably landed on English as a common thread. There was a sort of, should we start in Rwandese? But no, I think we pretty agreed, let's go with the English. Interestingly, in Rwanda, which is a French-speaking country colonially, they've now made it an English-speaking country. So it's not...
I'm sure the French are delighted with that. Just to add to their woes.
Yeah.
Andy from Leicester, after working in Kenya, but he's actually he's from Leicester, but he's in India. Yeah. After working in Kenya a few years ago, I noticed the amount of local buses decorated with colourful pictures of the top Premiership football sides. So when I saw this guy with his cart, he's enclosed a photograph, I had to snap a photograph. It just reminded me of this when your guest mentioned he was a Bolton fan. And what he has on this photograph is a very bright, colourful picture, but there it is in black and white. Mark, you describe that.
It's a huge cart of produce being dragged along by a man, and written boldly on the back of it is... Bolton Wanderers.
See, you should be more bold, really.
The Super Whites. We should have had Dudu in a Super White shirt.
So Africa United has got a good release, Ridian?
It has. It's in 200 screens, I think, from today.
I mean, you must be thrilled by that, because this is a low-budget film.
A year ago, I'd only just finished the script.
How much did it cost?
$4 million.
Oh, okay.
So, it's fantastic, and here it is, and we're going to see it at my local cinema tonight, and that's fantastic. And I saw a bus on the way.
I think that must be the ultimate excitement. I mean, the premiere is great. You know, taking the family is great. But when you see your film on a bus...
On a bus.
Actually, the other ultimate is to have voiceover guy doing your ad.
And does he do your ad?
In a world of football, he was a...
I think it's the critics are united.
Oh, no.
But it's great. You've got to have voiceover guy doing your ad, and then that's a box ticked.
Do you want to add anything to our code of conduct, Ridian, while you're here, about how to behave in a cinema? Because clearly with a 12A certificate, a lot of people, you know, there's going to be all kinds of misdemeanors happening.
I think laugh at the jokes loudly, but stop before the next line comes. And at the end of the film, pause for the emotion and then cheer very loudly.
That's really very specific, isn't it? They're going to find it hard to get that on a picture, you know, to illustrate it on a no running, no pushing, no jumping. And it would be quite nice, though, if you were actually, as a writer, you were able to stand there conducting the amount that they were allowed to laugh after each gag, because
stop
there's an
now,
important...
You're
stop,
listening.
Line coming!
Actually, I think there are probably 10 moments in the film where I think people should laugh, and I've been at 8 screenings and I'm always counting. And some laugh more at the other, you know, they don't always laugh at the same volume at the gag that they did last time. So, but no, if people laugh, that's great. And you can't always hear people crying, but you can tell.
Ridian, appreciate you coming in. Thank you very much. What are you going to work on next after the success, apparently, of this film? Certainly if the critics are united.
The critics are united. I'm working on a film for Scott Free, which is Ridley Scott's film company, that's set in post-war Germany. It's about the reconstruction of Germany. And it's a true story, actually, based on my grandfather. And it's very grown up and very bleak.
You're going to take your kids out of school and make them go to Germany?
I'm going to go and live in Hamburg for 9 months.
That's not so bad. That'll be fun. No word on the Scot-Free option on the Monopoly movie. You know what's happening with that?
I know nothing.
Apparently they own the rights to the movie of Monopoly.
Ridian, appreciate you coming in. Thank you very much
indeed.
Thank
you.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Kermode and Mayo's film review.
Delighted to say Leslie Manville joins us, star of the new Mike Leigh film, Another Year. How are you doing, Leslie?
I'm really well, thank you.
We are in the process of compiling a code of conduct for cinemas and cinema goers.
Oh, don't get me started.
Okay, well, I'm going to ask you for your contribution to our code of conduct in just a moment. Megan says, if you're... Megan, if you're stupid, don't go and see Inception. And there's a long... basically, yeah. She concludes, in short, stupid people should only watch intelligent movies on DVD. And she says, don't go whoop when someone removes their shirt or clothing. I've had this twice when forced to see two movies. Transformers 2, when, spoiler alert, a robot thing comes out of some woman's behind. Yeah. And New Moon, where Taylor Lautner is shirtless. New Moon, obviously, though, I thought it was some Scottish movie. Taylor Lautner is shirtless while speaking, but, of course, we couldn't hear that. So no whooping yes, when anyone takes their clothes off, and if you're stupid...
And the subject of that Transformers thing, only Michael Bay could make a plot point out of his camera looking up someone's skirt for the last 30 seconds.
Similarly,
pathetic.
Gavin in Worthing, while in America some years back, I went to see X-Men 2 at a multiplex. Huge action's appearance on screen was greeted with enthusiastic whoops and hollers. Feeling thoroughly British, I repressed my natural embarrassment and tried to enter into the spirit of the thing. However, rather than abating, the audience's excitement simmered until Huge lived up to his name and opened several cans of whoop-ass with his adamantium claws. The entire auditorium erupted in applause, with one particular gentleman jumping to his feet, yelling, "F yeah," repeatedly, while punching the air with his baseball cap. Perhaps it was my unhealthy English reserve, but the whole episode made me die a little inside. I'm all for expressing emotion and appreciation, but yelling and clapping at the screen during the film just seems imbecilic. Perhaps some kind of anti-panto commandment could be worthy of the tablets of stone. Alternatively, I propose a ban on pretentious irony flaggers who sit through Blue Velvet and force guffaws between every line of dialogue, ensuring we're all aware of just how dreadfully intelligent they are. Gavin, thank you. So we're all adding them into the big pot. What would you like to add, Leslie? What is it that annoys you the most about cinema attendees?
Noise. It's I want to hear a pin drop. And I can't stand it when people are eating popcorn, opening noisy bags of sweets, talking, texting. And unfortunately, I am one of those people who turns around and says, could you be quiet, please? Or would you mind being quiet, please? And I'm afraid I do it on the tube as well, and somebody's iPod's very loud.
But what do you usually get met with if you do that? Because a few times that I've done that, I've been met with a less than polite response, shall we say.
No, me too. I mean, never. People are seemingly astonished. I remember when I was in at the Sarajevo Film Festival about 8 years ago with Mike Lee. We went back to this new cinema that they'd built, and we walked through the foyer, and they'd installed, as part of the refit, a popcorn machine, and he was outraged, and he said as much. I mean, it's noise. I just want quiet, 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 quiet. You're there to go into this other place, aren't you, to see a movie and enter into this other world, but it just doesn't seem to be like that for people.
Have you ever said, would you mind being quiet, that's me on the screen?
No, I've never said that. No.
Maybe people who go see Mike Lee films are slightly better behaved. Are they more cine literate? I don't know. Or do they scoff themselves as much as anyone?
Well, no, interesting. I mean, I was interviewing...
Or Ken Loach fans be even better behaved? I don't know.
I was interviewing Mike Lee this very morning, and I think he's coming on the show in a couple of weeks' time as well. And I was talking about, you know, who the audience for a Mike Lee film is. He's absolutely adamant that the whole idea that a Mike Lee film somehow is an art house film or is complete nonsense. They're films for everybody. So as far as he was concerned, it would be exactly the same kind of... There isn't any sort of, if you come into a Mike Lee film, you're not going to be the kind of person who would eat popcorn and make a noise. So
yeah,
therefore, I think...
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that... I mean, I was certainly at some festivals I've been at with the film over the last few months. There's been popcorn eating. It's very, very annoying.
So quite a lot of correspondence has come in about food throwing, which is like the next stage, particularly... I mean, clearly it's Maltesers, M&Ms, all those kind of things that are small and very, very throwable. And they've sat on the like third row back and they've just had a torrent of sweets coming at them and hitting them on the head. I mean, that's going to annoy you after a while,
isn't it? It's the youth of today, isn't it?
Is that what it is?
Well, it's actually... I went see a film, and I went to see Charlie St. Cloud at the Multiplex in Southampton on Sunday. Yep. With George, we wanted to see it, but could the projectionist get the image to fit on the screen? No. Why? Because he was off doing the other screens, as far as I could tell. And the response from the cinema management on the subject of that's not quite the right shape was, shall we say, less than helpful.
Mm-hmm. So let's... enough of that, though there is so much stuff coming in on how to behave in the cinema. We will return to it on an occasional basis. Tell us about Another Year, Leslie, and your character there.
Oh, well...
You've forgotten about that, so you come in to promote
a film.
Yes, I thought
I was just coming in to have a good old moan.
Well, you can do that.
You can do that as well, but...
excuse me. Another Year is... it's a difficult film to describe, really, because it doesn't really have a major beginning, middle and end, and it doesn't have a great deal of plot, as it were, in the kind of classic sense. But it is about life and love and lack of love... relationships, loneliness, alcoholism. It's a kind of multifaceted piece of life. And I play Mary, who at the heart of the film is a couple that Jim Broadbent and Ruth Sheen play, who are called Tom and Jerry. And they're a very good couple. They are I guess what we're all sort of striving for. You know, they've got longevity, love, soulmates, all of that. But there's not a lot of drama in a happy couple, so there's got to be some chaos in their life, and other characters come into their lives. Mary is one of them, and she's a long-standing friend of theirs, and she's really the antithesis of what they are. She's very, very lonely. She's worried about getting older, losing her looks, not having a man. She's had a terrible life. She's never had any luck with relationships. She's profoundly lonely, and she drinks too much, and she talks too much, and it's funny. The film is very funny, but also what Mike does very well is he snaps you out of that and takes you to kind of poignancy and tragedy, and it's very touching as well.
Did you know, because obviously there's no script at the beginning, how big this role is? Because people, I mean, there is, I mean, look away now, Oscar talk. There are, you know, there are a lot of people who are saying very, very big things, not just about the film, but about your role in the film. How is that presented?
And it should be said that began at Cannes. As soon as the film was seen at Cannes, I mean, it immediately people have been talking about awards, so that has been going on for a while.
But so at what stage do you realise quite how big Mary is in this film?
Well, I mean, when you first start on the film, Mike just literally rings you up and says, do you want to be in the film? And it's either yes or no. I mean, he can't tell you anything about it because there isn't anything to tell. Because, believe it or not, we really do start with nothing. I mean, I think he has ideas and notions and themes, but he can't say to me, do you want to come and play this great character called Mary who's a lonely alcoholic? Because the pair of us haven't created her. And that's what we do in the first place. We work one-to-one and we... over a long time, and we don't do it in 3 days. I mean, we had 18 weeks on Another Year before the cameras came. Wow. So in that time...
That's a lot of rehearsal time, is it? Or is that fairly standard for a Mike Leigh film?
That's sort of standard now. I mean, when I started making films with him in the early 80s, and the first one I did was for the BBC, in fact, called Grown Ups, that was much shorter amount of time. But now that he makes cinema films, there's a bit longer. But it's not a long time when you think you start with nothing. I mean, you know, you were talking to your previous guest who was thinking about writing something. You know, you can be writing something for a year before you feel it's ready. But, you know, we do start with nothing. We create the character, and then Mike is the only person with a sort of overall vision of everything. And he'll start to pool, bring characters together, then you'll start to do improvisations and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then you start to... determine what the dialogue's going to be and pin it down. We don't ever improvise on camera, which is another myth. I think people think we just sort of start improvising and roll the cameras and see what happens, but it's more structured than that.
I have asked Mike Leigh to explain this process to me on several occasions, and on several occasions he's done so and I have failed to completely comprehend it, because it does seem to me that there's an element of alchemy and mystery in all this. And I asked him about it again today, and he said, well, the bottom line of it is it's nobody else's business how we get to this point. I mean,
that's not a very helpful answer.
No, but I think what he meant was, look, you know, it's actually not explainable. I think
the crucial thing is it's quite hard to explain it without it sounding a bit precious and a bit arty-farty, and, you know, you and without having quite a long time to describe it.
Sure. But is there is a point whereby after your improvisations, your workshops, you're talking through it, in which he will sit down and physically write a script or
no.
The script? No, so there's
No. By the time we are getting to the latter part of the rehearsals, we'll be doing master improvisations. Like, for example, the barbecue scene. I mean, we improvised a barbecue in real time with real food, not real drink, obviously, otherwise we'd all be legless. You know, that improvisation lasted 5 or 6 hours, you know, the real time that a barbecue would last. And then out of that, the real end product that you see has been distilled from that. What was your question? I've gone.
Shall I actually write down
this? What happens is that just before we start to shoot, he will go away for a few days and he will create a scenario of the journey of the film. But it'll be and he'll then talk to us one to one about what our character's journey is, what happens to them, what scenes they're going to be involved in. But it'll be as. It'll be one-liners. It'll be like scene one, Mary goes to visit Tom and Jerry. Scene two, Jerry's at work. You know, it's as brief as that. And then we start structuring those scenes, and then we shoot, structure. But it's never written down because the words that we say are the actors. The actors are improvising, so all the words that I say as Mary have come from me.
Alex, in Perth, and that's the Western Australia version of Perth, back on the code of conduct, what's needed, he says, is for large chains to redeploy the vast numbers of staff that apparently do nothing but mill around the lobby like carp in a pond, to stand in the screenings for the duration of the performance and dish out the same kind of no-nonsense frontier justice to smokers, texters and talkers that I remember as a child. I'm only 27, but the fear of a torchlit shaming at the hands of an usher taught me early on that the cinema was a public place, not merely your living room writ large.
There was a cinema chain in America who back in the 1980s actually did start doing that, the proper security guards in the screen, that if you spoke loudly in the screen they would go in and manhandle you out of the screen. I'm all for it. I want an armed response.
Leslie Manville is talking about Another Year, which is the new Mike Leigh film, I wonder if the whole area of improvisation, which you say is not what you're seeing on camera, but there has been a lot of it up to that point, is one of the most baffling and mysterious areas to anyone who doesn't act, has no contact with the world of acting. How on earth can you research a character and then look at Jim Broadbent and start making stuff up? It just seems absolutely extraordinary.
I know. And I think that's probably because you sort of think that improvising is just about literally you turning up today and saying, right, OK, let's improvise a scene where you're this and an idiot, which would be terrible
and
embarrassing.
But you've done that, haven't you?
No, but it isn't like that because you've spent months. I mean, you know, every character in the film has had their whole lives filled in. You know, I created my character, Mary, from her childhood, you know, so everything about her child, where she went to school, what the temperature of her family life was like. And so you know them. So by the time you get to the point where the character's the age they are and you're improvising the scenes, you could put that character in any situation almost, and you don't really have to think how to behave. It just kind of happens.
Have you ever said no to Mike Leigh? Because I think you've been in more of his films than anyone else.
No, I haven't. No, it's such nice work, really. And I mean, that's not to negate the fantastic work that I do with other directors when there's a script involved, but it's just very interesting because a lot's being asked of you. You know, it's he can't do it without you. He doesn't sit down and write it. It does come from the collaboration between him and the actors. So, you know, it's ever so exciting and unusual, and you start and you just absolutely no idea where this thing's going to end up.
Is there any sense that when you've worked as many times with Mike Leigh as you have, that working with other directors is, to be polite, you know, perhaps you don't have the same freedom, perhaps you don't have the same, you know, because working with Mike sounds like, from an actor's point of view, it's the ideal environment. It's completely collaborative. He obviously trained as an actor himself. He understands how to speak. I can't imagine that every director is like that.
No, but it would be wrong of me to go and work with another director and expect them to run a rehearsal like Mike does, because we're working with a script in those instances. And it doesn't mean that directors aren't fantastically creative just because you start with something that you have to make work. And it doesn't mean that you don't do lots of interesting stuff around the script to invest in it and to make the performance more interesting. But I think it would be wrong to sort of say, oh, come on, let's do some improvising, and why aren't I researching this character's life from the day they were born? Because that's just not the way everyone's going to be working.
And Simon was saying earlier on that there's been, you know, there is obviously awards buzz. The film was in Cannes. There was a lot of interest in it in Cannes. I tipped it wrongly as a Palme d'Or winner. So almost certainly cursed it by doing that, so I apologise to you for that. How important is awards recognition?
Well, I mean, I've been acting for over 30 years and I've got one award, so clearly it's
what
not
was that. What was that?
It was the London Critics Circle Award that I won for another Mike Leigh film called All or Nothing. But, you know, that's all I've won. So clearly it's not that important, because I've hardly had a non-career because of it. But by the same token, I'm sure it helps. You know, when I speak to Jim Broadbent about his Oscar, he kind of says, yeah, well, you know, the thing is, it kind of adds another naught to your fee. And I kind of think, well, that would be very nice, you know, another naught to my fee. I suppose it gives you more choice and more work's going to come your way, and you're going to have a bit more clout, you know.
And does this role feel... I mean, do you feel more excited about people going to see this film because of the way the characters develop? Because clearly, I mean, people are going to come out and Jim Broadbent's in it, but it comes back to you. You know, you are the focus of the film.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I feel that that you know, this is a very good film for me, and it's a very. I think when you first see Mary in the film, or even for the first half of the film, you kind of think you've got her number and you know where it's going to go. But events do happen, and it is a great sort of opportunity to show the terrible side of this woman's life as opposed to the upside of it.
At the risk of asking a lovey sounding question, obviously the central thing about your character in the film is that she's the lonely one, and actually during the course of the movie the level of her loneliness is very painful, and at the end of the movie that you just go, if you carry that character around with you for however many months you do for the research and then for the process of the filming, do you not, is there not a sense of carrying around that loneliness with you? Because there's an awful lot of the film in which there'll be scenes going on, there'll be people getting on, but there is Mary. The face of Mary is the face of isolation, the face of loneliness. She is carrying the weight of the Mike Lee,
yes.
You know.
Not well, I think for a lot of actors that is the case. I think a lot of actors take it home and find it hard to get rid of it, but I don't really.
You switch off.
I do switch off. But I think it's partly to do with... This kind of shorthand we get by the time we're shooting something that we've rehearsed for so long with Mike, because you know you get into character, you do the scene, and then you sort of, you get very used to the discipline of going in and out of character, and so we do these big emotional scenes, and then you know whilst they're relighting or turning the cameras around and all that, we go and have a cup of tea, and I'm completely forgetting about it, and then you go back in and do it again. But that's just me. I think other people do. I believe Daniel Day-Lewis, you know, likes to...
Lives the dream.
Live it and breathe it. And I'm that living it and breathing it whilst I'm doing it, but I'm really easy at saying goodbye to it.
Just imagine being around Daniel Day-Lewis when he was making There Will Be Blood. Cannot have been a bunch of laughs, can it?
Look out, he's home.
Everyone, hide the shoes.
Everyone take cover. What are you working on next, Leslie?
I'm going to be doing a film in New York called The Preppy Connection, which is based on the true story of some kids in 1984 at a school who got very involved in drug smuggling from Colombia. So I'm going to be playing the German mother of the protagonist.
Have you signed the contract for that? Because you know,
no.
If you win, you know that you need that naught on the end of your.
I know. I know if they.
Still to be negotiated.
Listen, let's not jump the gun.
Are you doing the character in German, or are you doing it with a comedy German accent?
That would be great.
Perhaps I should do it with a comedy German accent. All right, then I will.
Leslie Manville stars in Mike Lee's new film, Another Year. Leslie, thank you very much indeed for coming in. We appreciate that. Thank you. Nick and son Jeremy, first of all, saying, Jeremy, my 12-year-old son, and I need your advice. He is planning a Halloween party for his friends. We can't agree on a suitable Halloween movie for 8 12-year-old boys. So Hole is kind of out of this because it won't be available on DVD, yeah. I imagine. He wants something that will scare him and his pals, and having ploughed his way through various online movie trailers, thinks that Trick or Treat on DVD would be suitable. Being rated 15, I am saying no way. Yeah. Can you help resolve our dispute? So 8 12-year-old boys, they want a horror movie for Halloween. What should they go for?
Yeah, well, not that. I mean, it's so difficult.
Not that.
Yeah, no, because it's a 15. You know, I always point this out. The Vanishing is a 12-certificate film, but scared the living daylights out of me. My suggestion would be, actually, go back to, you know, like the classic Hammers, or, you know, even the Abbott and Costellas, which are actually very good.
That's no good.
Why?
Because they're 12. They'll want to see something new and exciting and different and interesting.
There was that cartoon not so long ago, Monster House, which is just a little bit creepy. See, 12's a very difficult... have they seen Jaws? I mean, Jaws is the scariest 12-certificate movie, you know, that's kind of available for everybody.
If they want to watch a Halloween movie, they might be disappointed if they get Shark Movie.
It's a scary movie.
Yeah, they want to...
Fine, in that case, find my original suggestion, which is go watch the 1931 Frankenstein, watch one of the... you know, something like that. Those are Carry On Screaming. I mean, you know, these are all great PG-12 rated movies with a bunch of stuff happening in them that are quite scary.
Nosferatu?
I mean, otherwise, you know, you're onto things like The Haunting, which scared the life out of me. Nosferatu is a good call.
But a cinema trip to that... If you could find The Hole still being on...
Yeah, I mean, The Hole is, but as Joe Dante said, there are very few horror movies which exist in... that area. That's the point.
Kermode and Mayo's film review.
The UK cinema top 10.
Five Live. Eat, Pray, Loves at 10.
Vomit.
The Death and Life of Charlie St. Cloud at 9.
Great, and even better when projected correctly onto the screen.
The Other Guys at 8.
You know, Mark Wahlberg, thumbs up. Everything else, can't be bothered.
Made in Dagenham at number 7.
Well, you know how much I like Made in Dagenham. I like Made in Dagenham very much. I'd be very surprised if at the end of the year it's not in my top 5 favourite films. But as we know, 15 certificate rather than 12 certificate.
And why would that be?
Well, the reason it was given a 15 certificate, according to the BBFC, is that it features 17 uses of the F word. And when Stephen Woolley was on the programme recently, he was saying, well, the fact is that that's, you know, it doesn't matter. The word isn't used aggressively. It should be given a 12 certificate because it's an important story that should be seen by 12-year-olds. And the BBFC said, and I have to say that I was, you know, played devil's advocate with him, that actually it's a simple logistical thing. If you have 17 F uses, you are going to be a 15. That's the beginning end of it. They're not going to back down this, Stephen.
That's right, that's right. So that's where we were.
That's
there
where
have
we
been
were.
Developments. Hello, Stephen Woolley.
Simon.
You're becoming...
And Mark, Stephen.
Yes, Mark.
Thank you.
OK, you're up and you're going and you're kicking with this. So what is it that's got your goat now,
well,
Stephen?
What's really upset me... And, Simon, you were particularly rough with me the last time we had this conversation. What's really upset me is they've just given The King's Speech, which is a really wonderful little film. It's a real gem. Colin Firth gives a great performance. It's about somebody with a speech impediment who happens to become the King of England, and they've given it a 12A certificate, and it has 15 uses of the word F. 15. So just two short of vowels. So I'm very, very upset with the censor, because they had originally given it a 15, and then they backtracked and gave it a 12A.
What is the explanation that has been given, Stephen?
The explanation is that because he's got a speech impediment, and because the word, the F word, is used as a sort of continuous... rhythmical kind of machine gun effect
therapy
in two scenes, that therefore it's all okay. And I just don't get it, because it doesn't say anywhere in the BBFC rules and regulations that if you say the F word continuously over a shorter period of time, it's okay.
Well, interestingly, in the BBFC statement, they refer to the fact that, you know, the therapeutic use of it. They also make specific reference in their ruling to the fact that there will be cases, mm-hmm. in which unforeseen cases in which circumstances will arise, which means that it cannot be a hard and fast rule. About what they're essentially saying is it doesn't come down to simply counting the swear words.
Well, let me just tell you what Lynn Featherston, who was the Equality Minister, had to say about the film. I hope that everyone sees it. It is truly inspiring. Although, for reasons I don't understand, other than the F word it's used, it's going to get a 15 certificate. Given the violent films that are passed for children, I'm a bit surprised that something this educational, entertaining, and brilliant cannot be seen by those under 15.
So, on a simple point, is your...
She is the Equality Minister.
No, is your contention, therefore, that if they are going to give the King's Speech a 12 certificate with the use of the F word that it has, that the only way of showing parity is therefore that Made in Dagenham should have the same benefit?
Absolutely. I think that Made in Dagenham is a film that 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds, 14-year-olds should not be banned from seeing.
Do you suspect that the truth of this then, Stephen, is that aristocratic swearing is different to working class swearing?
You said that. Not me.
I did, but is that what you're...
I can't see any other reason. Simon, have you seen Made in Dagenham yet?
I haven't.
Well, please go and see it this weekend.
OK.
It's very, very important. It's a very important film, and it's a film that parents really want their children to see. And I've done Q&As for this film across the width and breadth of the nation with my producing partner, Elizabeth. And we ask people in Bath, and we ask people in Glasgow, we ask people in Newcastle, we ask people in Merthyr Tydfil, would you want your children to see this movie? And 100% said yes. Not 70% of the audience. Everyone in the audience that saw the film said yes, they want their 12-year-olds, their 13-year-olds, their 14-year-olds, even their 10-year-olds to see the film. We asked teachers from the East End of London, would you show this to your 12-year-olds in your class? And they unanimously said yes. So how come school teachers, the general public, and Lynn Featherston can agree on something being... good. How can the film critics, we've just won 3 prizes in DNR for the film, it's just been given the British Film of the Year by the Variety Club Show Business Awards, how can all these people agree, and yet the censor sits there and says, well, I'll give it to King's Speech, which is about the royal family, but I'm not going to give it to you, even though overwhelmingly, people want their kids to see the movie.
It's not for nothing that they call him Steve Let It Lie Woolley.
Stephen,
I let go of it. Guys, last time I was on your show, I let it go. Mark said very firmly, you will never, ever get a 12A certificate with that amount of the use of the word. Yeah. In our film, it's used unthreateningly.
You should have put a king in your film.
Not enough royalty, Stephen. That's your problem. Not enough
problem.
Royalty in
I
general.
I was born in the wrong place at the wrong time,
Stephen,
I know.
Stephen, thank you very much indeed. That's Stephen Woolley's 12 minutes past three. We continue as we... I don't think there are any other producers who want to pop up as we do this. The Town at six.
Which is fine, but not more than fine.
Life as We Know It at five.
Which is really predictable. And if you've seen the poster, you've seen the entire movie.
Wall Street Money Never Sleeps at number four. Just an email here from Charlie in Dubai. He said, I had the pleasure, yes, that's right, Mark, the pleasure of watching Wall Street 2, dampened by an endless stream of people entering after Gecko had been released from prison and people talking all the way through. Anyway, he says, in the UAE, where I live, cinema goers can watch films in gold class. You pay about £18 for the experience. You get a waiter bringing food to you, sitting on large lazy boy chairs. And when the aircon gets too cold, you can order a blanket. So Charlie is saying, how about no blanket ruffling being added to the list, which is a good one. Vampire Sucks at three.
I mean, you know, there was the review in America, Vampire Sucks, you know, and so does this movie. There's just no point in getting cross with that movie for being... I'm glad it's gone in at three, not number one. That's a relief anyway.
This is Steve in Shrewsbury. I've agreed with the good doctor on many occasions.
Oh, don't tell me he enjoyed Vampire Suck.
But I've never understood his enthusiasm for Twilight. I paid three times to watch each episode of this tedious saga in an attempt to understand what the fuss was all about. During each, I was fed up looking at my watch far too many times. Vampires are meant to be scary, not caught up in some teenage angst drivel. Therefore, I have no problem at all that I paid to see Vampires Suck. Who cares how long it took them to release it after the Twilight boat hit the iceberg? It's not important. I enjoyed seeing the rubbish being sent up.
I'm just not rising to it.
The Social Network is at two.
Which I like very much. It's the most exciting movie you could have made about a bunch of unlikable people sitting in rooms going online and arguing about copyright.
This from Ewan. I went to see Social Network this week at my local World of Cine. After standing behind people buying £50 worth of snacks, I finally got in. Whenever I go to the cinema, I try to use the good doctor's proven There Will Be Blood seating arrangement, which was particularly effective with Buried. However, people eventually filled the seats in front and behind me. Then two teenagers in front of me broke the Wittertainment code of conduct and started fiddling with their phones. I thought the film was fantastic, with impeccable writing and Fincher's very green direction, but be ready to feel very poor and stupid compared with Mark Zuckerberg. That's very true.
Yeah.
You will feel poor and
stupid
next to him. The UK's number one is Despicable Me.
Which, you know, for me is an unremarkable digimation with celebrity voiceovers that will not stand the test of time. But, hey, it's half term.
You're a difficult man to please, Mark, says this email. But I guess that's part of the job. I could easily have slept through this film, but it kept me awake and my two boys loved it. It lacked originality, but why does every film with a 3D influence have to be reviewed through its quality of 3D-ness?
It doesn't. I didn't review it as a 3D movie. As a movie, it's a bit boring and terribly derivative.
Nigel Pittman says, there is no gentle way of putting this, Mark, but... in
You're becoming
letters,
boring.
No, you are wrong.
Oh, I see.
I've heard Mark rave and eulogise about Toy Story, where I took the kids, Buster 9 and Keaton 7. Now, can I just say, if that's true, Nigel, that's brilliant. Two kids, Buster and Keaton.
Very good.
To see that some months ago. I thought it was good, but sat waiting for this big emotional climax, which never came. Having heard your less than flattering view of Despicable Me last Friday, I took the kids with some trepidation. However, it turned out to be a total surprise. Funny, engaging, and I thought far more poignant than Toy Story. Both my children agreed that it was better than Toy Story, and also Diary
of... You have to stop.
Diary
of a Wimpy Kid. You have to stop now.
No, you have to be quiet, just for a moment. So I am afraid that due to the democratic process that has taken place, it has been duly confirmed that you are most definitely wrong, according to the Pittman family.
No. It's just the Despicable Me better than Toy Story.
Yes.
It's, you know, up is down, left is right.
Claire in Wimbledon says, last night I was the fortunate recipient of a freebie ticket to the screening of Paranormal Activity 2 at the Odeon West End. As my friend and I took our seats, a familiar face loomed large. It was, of course, the good Dr. Kermode. I was desperate to say hello, but an unusual shyness when faced with a celeb came upon me, and I kept silent, even as I followed him out of the cinema after the screening. And all the way home, Oh, I added that bit. Preferring instead just to stare in awe at his beautifully maintained quiff. When I returned home and recounted the tale to my partner, he showed extreme disappointment that I didn't say hello and thank Dr. K and, of course, Dr. M for all the hours of audio pleasure that you've given us over the past few years. Can I take the opportunity to say thank you and ask you to please say hello to my long-suffering partner, Alex? The fact that I was more excited and enthralled about Dr. K's presence than the film will, I think, say it all.
It does.
Do you remember Claire in Wimbledon?
I don't, because she was behind me, apparently. So it's,
she followed you home.
Yeah, well, so Paranormal Activity 2 wasn't press screened until last night when it opened, so that's not really a press screening. And as you probably know, the way it works is that when they don't show movies to the press, they say, oh, it's because we want to preserve the surprise. We don't show the horror movies to critics anymore because we want the fans to see them first. The person who came up with this theory first was the producer of The Avengers, who actually used to produce Elvis concerts. And he was doing the publicity circuit for The Avengers, saying, yes, well, the reason we're not showing it to the critics is we want to give the fans a treat by letting them see first. So the treat for Paranormal Activity is that it opened, you know, started screening last night, and that's when we got to see it for the first time. So there we go. There has never, in my memory, been a case in which you haven't been shown a movie because the critics think it's because the distributors think it's really brilliant. They just want to give the treat to the audience. The only reason you're not shown a film is because either it's rubbish, or because the distributors think it's rubbish, or because they think the critics are going to think it's rubbish. In the case of Paranormal Activity, made for no money whatsoever, I think from 11,000 by Ron Pelly, became a whopping success, took something like 183 million. And as you know, the original was like this video document of a couple in a house, and the house appears to have some dark force within it, and it was all the videotape stuff. So if my conclusion about it was, the more you knew about horror films, the more predictable and, you know, solidly done, but, you know, and interestingly put together with some nice moments, but not something that really upset me. But James King, who, you know, the Radio 1 critic, for example, was genuinely creeped out by Paranormal Activity. I mean, he's not such a big horror fan as I am, and so clearly it worked on that level. It was inventive. It did the most that you could do with what is essentially Ghost Watch meets Blair Witch in a post-Cannibal Holocaust found footage way. And Cannibal Holocaust had an awful lot to answer for in terms of the whole found footage cycle, which went on from there. So there's no denying that the original Paranormal Activity was a good idea, well executed, that, as I said, from where I'm standing, was more scary the less you knew about horror films, therefore had a really big impact with mainstream audience. Good for it. Paranormal Activity 2, or to give it its correct title, Paranormal Inactivity Part 2. It's probably not a good idea to say to an audience at the beginning of the film that in 60 days' time a significant death is coming, because you immediately start to look at your watch and think, I could grow an entire new set of teeth in that time. So the story is that there is a family in a house with a young baby and complicated family relationships. Obviously, at the very beginning, the house appears to have been broken into, and so therefore they have to get cameras put all around the house, and then stuff starts to happen around the house in the manner of Paranormal Activity 2. There are a couple of familiar faces, well, a significant familiar face, and this whole thing will connect up with Paranormal Activity 1. And what I don't want to do is, I don't want to give too much away in terms of, I do understand that if people want to go and see Paranormal Activity Part 2, right, they are, you know, they should be entitled to have whatever surprises are there. Here's what I can tell you about it. It is one of the most boring things I have ever seen. The day that I saw it yesterday, I came to it after having had an hour and a half of dental work done. And the dental work was both more upsetting, more exciting, and more creatively rewarding in the end. Here is how Paranormal Activity Part 2 goes, okay? And it's generally, the film goes like this. Boo! 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 But the interesting thing is that the goes on forever. Forever. It's like watching day 45 in the Big Brother household. No paranormal activity as yet. In a moment, a pot will fall on the floor.
Does someone actually do that noise?
I mean, it was just stunning. And here's the thing. Alfred Hitchcock once said that the secret to great drama is, you know, you have a conversation with a bomb under a table, right? the audience know that there's a bomb under the table, then the conversation is full of tension. You know, anything everybody said, because you know there's a thing going off. This is like that, except they forgot to put the bomb under the table. So there is just boredom. It's snoring, interspersed by occasional loud bangs. By the time stuff starts happening, and it is a long way off, you are so uninterested in anybody and so disappointed that all they have managed to do is to rehash the riffs that were done for. I mean, this one cost best part of $3 million, so it's massively more expensive than the original. It's a film made by somebody who said, that's a good idea. I understand how they did it the first one. What is it about the first one that really works? Oh, I'll tell you what it is about the first one that really works, is that there's long build-ups to everything, and then very sudden things happening that very sudden. Okay, so long build-up. Boo! And it just... I mean, honestly, I was... just gnawing at my knuckles. Now, here's the interesting thing. Sit next to James King, right? James was sent into paroxysms of despair once and said he literally couldn't sleep afterwards. My head was right on my side of this, looking over at James. Is James in any way to... The rest of the audience, who are probably a non-horror crowd, there are a couple of moments in which people, out of some form of sort of sympathy, were, you know, when the initial bangs happen, because some of the bangs are quite loud bangs. And the fact is, if you go up to anyone and go bang behind them, they get a little jump. That's not really such a big deal. There was a couple of bangs and then a couple of, ooh. Did it go anywhere? No. Was it scary? No. Was it predictable? Yes. Did I care about the people? No. Did I think at any point I was witnessing something that was a reality, blah, 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 playing out? No. Did I want it to be over? Yes. Was it dragging its feet like never before? Yes. And did any sense of threat entirely exist on the basis that, you know, the movie before, which had the same two words in the title, that was a bit creepy? Well, it's like that, only...
Can I suggest something? Yes, I can. Was your mood affected by the fact you just had an hour and a half of dental work? Yes, it almost certainly was.
Nope. I know. I mean, I wanted to like it because I wanted to like it.
But you just had an hour. You've just been at the dentist.
Yeah,
for
and
hour.
I was out.
Your face was numb. You were in pain. No, how were you expected to go to any kind
I
of?
I felt
film,
really good.
Which you
my
had to be
in,
paid
my
to see.
In lovely shape. My teeth were in lovely shape as a result of it. And I sat and I rushed to the cinema and there was James. It's great. And there was Alan Jones, who I like. And there's Nigel Floyd, my best friend. Sat down. Yeah, come on, bring on the scares. Da 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 da.
I think that's the anaesthetic kicking in.
Yeah, the anaesthetic is exactly what Paranormal Activity is. And boredom like you have never seen. Just wait till, literally, wait till the punter reviews start coming in. I paid, you know, £7.50 to see Paranormal.
Right, here's the alternative view from Chris in Cardiff. BSc Honours, MIDM, DIP, IDM, not quite sure.
Boom.
Diploma of something. Mark and Simon, I am eagerly anticipating Mark's review of Paranormal Activity 2. My friends and I watched it last night in an opening screening. The packed cinema gasped and swore in unison, and it certainly prevented each of us from getting a good night's sleep last night. Keep up the great work, says Chris in Cardiff.
It was rubbish.
Well, clearly, he thought it was great.
It was rubbish. It was, and not only was it rubbish, it was knock-off, overinflated, self-important, full of itself, you know, direct, I mean, lowest common denominator annoyance rubbish. And there's, you know, as I said, there's a reason why they didn't really want critics. Oh, we don't want critics to see it because we don't want them to spoil the surprise. The surprise being, it's incredibly dull.
Horror movies for 12-year-olds.
Yeah, I think Paranormal Activity too.
Victoria.
Go on, wake up, kids. Go on.
Victoria in Liverpool. A quiet enough of the sound effects. It's getting slightly irritating.
Yeah.
The 12-year-old.
You should sit through the movie doing it.
The 12-year-old. Read the 12-year-old party suggestion. A quiet, creepy horror won't work in a party situation, but the Vincent Price Theatre of Blood.
Yeah.
And then that was a horrific.
Yeah,
laugh.
Show them, show but then a bunch Victoria, of 12-year-olds that.
Victoria adds, or an American Werewolf in London. Now,
no, that's,
what you've forgotten, Victoria, I think that's a 15, and you've probably forgotten the shower sequence.
It must be an 18, American Werewolf. When it first came out, it was certainly an 18.
Remember that shower sequence?
Simon, I'm 47. Of course I remember that shower sequence.
I've just, maybe Victoria's forgotten it in suggesting that you show it to... Okay, welcome back. Johnny, what did you see at the your friend's party? We saw an American Werewolf in London.
With that girl out the railway, children.
My word. Who would have thought? She's older. This from John in Brentford. Perfect movie for a 12-year-old's party. Poltergeist. Perfect mix of horror suspense. That's an 18, isn't
it? Yeah, well, it was an 18. It's now a 15, I think. It was, when I first saw it, it was what was then the old X18 certificate. In fact, Poltergeist is surprisingly discreet. The scariest things in Poltergeist are the, you know, like the clown and all that stuff. Which, of course, but there's a Poltergeist clown in the hole. But no, you can't show it to 12-year-olds. Are you mad?
And this from Sid in Middlesbrough. So, but we've moved off from horror. The Dark Knight, he said, is 12. That should be scary enough. And it is scary.
Yes, it is
12, but it's not a Halloween film. So,
I think that's arguable. I mean, you could say the Harry Potter movies are Halloween films because they're obviously influenced by Hammer. You could say the Dark Knight is because the Joker figure is clearly a sort of gothic horror character. And Dark Knight is a full on 12 certificate film. You know, that's about as. Yeah, I mean, I think there are the Joker stuff in that is genuinely creepy.
Is there anything that you wanted to mention before the news?
No, that's fine, except for...
Helen Williams says, I went to see Paranormal Activity 2 last night in a packed cinema and thought it was far better than the first one. I have never witnessed... That is very patronising laugh, by the way. Very, very patronising. I have never witnessed a cinema jumping and screaming in unison like that. All I'm saying is there's clearly another world out there, Mark, which you don't inhabit. Would you say that's fair?
You know, I'm not going anywhere near it. It bored me rigid.
Code of conduct here. This from Steel Magnolia on the blog. This should be writ large on all entrances to cinemas. The cinema is not a social experience. If you think it is, turn around now. In terms of conduct, I think cinemas could learn a lot from British campsites, which say, no noise after dark, no single-sex groups, no stag or hen parties, no naked flames, and no barbecues. So that is just an interesting starting point, then, for our code of conduct, which we are assembling over the next couple of weeks. There are 10 movies out this week. We've reviewed one of... Well, Mark's talked about
two.
One of the... Two,
yeah,
of them.
We talked about, you know, we Africa United, you and I
Africa
were...
Africa United, pretty... absolutely, yes, very good. Let's go through a whole bunch more. What comes next?
Red. The poster for Red tells you, 4 stars, one of the most entertaining experiences to be had in the cinema this year. IGN.com.
IGN.com?
IGN. Use IGN.com. Anyway.
You're the critic.
No, but I'm saying, yes, exactly. The point is, big letters, entertaining experience we had in the cinema, IGN.com.
Never heard of them.
Well, you and me both. So, anyway, adaptation of a graphic novel by Warren Ellison Cullyhammer. And it's had a sort of respectable open. I think it's covered its budget in America so far. Directed by Robert Schwenker, who most recently wrestled with Time Traveler's Wife. Story is, Bruce Willis is a CIA agent who is Red. He is retired and extremely dangerous. At the beginning of the movie, we see him on the phone, spending his days ringing up Mary Louise Parker, with whom he's sort of having a phone love relationship. He's complaining that his pension hasn't arrived. She's saying, I'm going to send you the check. He's actually ripping up the check so that he can ring her back. Then, one day, assassins attempt to kill him, and he clicks straight back into being a hot Secret Service agent. And then goes off to meet up with a bunch of other people to sort of unravel the plot as to why he has been targeted for assassination. Kidnapping en route, the Mary Louise Parker character, who he now believes to be in danger. So for her own good, takes her on board. And then rounds up his old associates, which is essentially Morgan Freeman, who's an avuncular old codger now living in a retirement home. John Malkovich, who's a twitchy, paranoid guy who lives underground and is convinced that everybody's out to get him. Helen Mirren, who's a feisty dame who looks great in a dress and even better with a huge machine gun. And Brian Cox, who plays a bearded Ruski. Here's a clip.
The entire back half of the Guatemala file has been blacked out. But there's a list. 11 names plus one that's been redacted.
All dead, except for Frank and Marvin.
All the names on the reporter's list are in the file, too, but she has an additional name. Alexander Dunning. Somebody's protecting him.
Dunning is the CEO of Browning Orvis.
Gangsters.
Defense contractor. Very connected.
You know, if the CIA is protecting him, he's under surveillance.
We could go see him.
We're not going without me.
Well, we're getting the band back together.
Which is a reference to the Blues Brothers. We're getting the band back together. And funnily enough, there is that sort of feel to it. Now, obviously, whenever you see a poster, which the main quote is from IGN.com, you think, right, that's because there's been a scarcity of great reviews from which they can quote. Interestingly enough, I kind of enjoyed Red. I mean...
You're right, though. There is a scarcity of good reviews.
Yes, I'm sure that's the case. I mean, I haven't read the other ones, but I...
Say it's pants.
Is that the general feeling?
It does seem to be.
It's not pants. I think to some extent, in order to enjoy it, you have to have a level of goodwill towards it and towards the character. There was an article by Warren Ellis today talking about the...
Who's he?
The writer of the graphic novel, talking about the... you know, the resurgence of movies with older characters in them, like, for example, The Expendables, and saying, you know, the fact of the matter is that there's a whole bunch of actors out there who have grown up, and there's an older audience who've kind of grown up with them and quite want to see movies in which those older actors come out of retirement, put the stuff back on, and do it. The phrase that he uses is this, I'm quoting him here. He says, while you're playing with the computer games they don't like or understand, they're buying seats at the cinema to watch films about you getting kicked in the face by them. So there is a sort of a running riff all the way through this here. R.E.D., retired, extremely dangerous, people being taken out of retirement. Morgan Freeman's character says, you know, I've seen Vietnam, I've seen Afghanistan, but I never thought I'd end up in the, you know, Sleepy Hollow retirement home. And there is clearly a sort of joyous gag going on all the way through the film about the idea that these people are all past it in a sort of post-Expendables way. I wouldn't make any claims to it being a great piece of work whatsoever, but I have to say that I enjoyed the performances. I thought it nipped along at a sort of fairly leisurely pace, but never boring. Mary Louise Parker was really great. I thought she did the most with a difficult role, because that role could quite easily just be the cipher role. It could be the role in which there isn't really anything grand to do. John Malkovich does the John Malkovich thing. There's one line in it.
How would I know when I see John Malkovich do
well,
his thing?
The John Malkovich thing is, okay, twitchy, nerdy, strange, weird, slight, you know, hamming it up. I mean, you know, here's the thing with John Malkovich. He's one of those people who on stage was meant to be a great thesp, although I went to see him on stage doing, was it Burn This?
And I don't know, you were there.
Yeah, I think it was Burn This.
Was it Burn This?
I think it was Burn This. And I was like five rows. Nobody could hear a word he was saying because he was talking to the floor. He was in that, you know, Malkovich thing. He was doing that. But every now and then he just rolls out the John Malkovich. You know, it's like you've got one of these movies. We want somebody twitchy, strange, slightly edgy, slightly odd, slightly quirky. I know, is John Malkovich busy? Let's get him. And he does that perfectly fine. But actually, when you look at the constituent elements of Red, it works perfectly fine, and it is nice to see those actors enjoying themselves in those roles. I think to some extent it's a movie that will play better the further up the aging chain you are. I mean, for a 47-year-old, seeing Bruce Willis being dragged out of retirement to run around doing his action stuff was oddly pleasurable. And I didn't mind it at all. It's no masterpiece, but it was perfectly good fun.
IGN.com is an entertainment game website.
Okay.
In case you wanted to know what who they were and why they were commenting.
Well, as I said, no work of genius, but perfectly good fun. Can I tell you briefly about The Arbor?
Why don't you tell us briefly about The Arbor and then we can move on?
Which is a docudrama, is that the way to describe it? It is on one level a documentary about the playwright Andrea Dunbar, who had her plays produced when she was very, very young, died very, very young, left behind some extraordinary work, wrote Rita Sue and Bob 2, which was obviously filmed. And what's happened is that Claire Bernard, who's directed this, and this is from the Art Angel stable, has gone back to the estate on which she grew up and done a number of things. Firstly, they have staged scenes from her work there in the estate. But what they've done for the bulk of the piece is to take recordings of people who knew her, people who are related to her, people who work with her, audio recordings, right? And then got actors to lip sync to the audio recordings on screen. Now, when you describe that technique, it sounds, you think, no, that's not going to work, right? That is not going to work. People, actors lip syncing to documentary audio tapes. What, you know, how is that gonna, what's it gonna do? Now obviously this owes to some extent a debt to the verbatim theatre tradition, and there are sort of roots of this.
It sounds a bit like the Dennis Potter Pennies from Heaven sequences where the actors would, like Michael Gambon as well, would lip sync to clearly
songs.
Old songs.
Yeah, sure. Well, yeah. It's like that, only in that it's lip syncing. Here's what I think happens in the case, and I have to say I'm very impressed by The Arbor. I did not expect the effect of it to be anything like as strong as it was. When you are watching these, the stories that they're telling are very harrowing, very difficult. I mean, there is tough stuff in The Arbor. This is a tough life, stories of tough lives. When you are watching people acting, lip syncing to audio that you know to be real, But what they're doing is a performance. What it actually does is, in an oddly unintrusive way, it highlights that difference between what's true and what's fictional, what's absolute and what is vague, what is certain truth and what is interpreted truth. And essentially what it does is it tells you, as the story is being told, that every person has a different version of a story. Every person's version of somebody is their own version of somebody. And it questions that central idea that just because somebody said something and it appears to be factual doesn't mean it is an absolute truth. Now, that sounds, I know when I say it like that, it sounds terribly dry, terribly sort of theoretical, and you can't imagine there being, you know, a whole lot of pleasure in watching that movie. The extraordinary thing about The Arbor is that it found a dramatic way of getting that complex idea across, in which was oddly mesmerizing, particularly considering the difficulty of the subject matter, the raw emotion of some of these stories, the really challenging nature of some of the situations that are being described, that are being explained. I thought they had really hit upon something. As I said, I understand that it has theatrical roots. I understand, you know, there is a debt owed to verbatim. But what I saw on screen really surprised me and really made me think, blimey, that is so much more than an experiment. That is an experiment that has worked, that has been thought through, that is aesthetically and intellectually complete, and it works, and it's interesting, and it's moving, and you won't see another film like it in the cinema at the moment.
The Code of Conduct is going to be compiled over the next couple of weeks. Thank you for the hundreds and hundreds of suggestions. Keep them coming. That we will try and sort of narrow it down to the 10 rocks on which we shall stand. Shaz, on this Shaz Thompson. Unfortunately, I have to put up my hand and admit that my six-year-old son would be ejected from your cinema under the no-spoiling rule. At the age of six, my son wanted to go and see The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, but as cinema-going parents, we wanted to be sure that he would, one, sit through it all, two, not ask questions, three, not fall asleep after paying to get in ice creams and so on, and four, ultimately, enjoy the experience. Well, we decided to read him the book, and it worked. He was thrilled to be going, sat beautifully all the way through until Aslan is killed on the high altar.
Giving away the end!
You could hear a pin drop as that... Okay, I'm going to pursue this to the end, okay? If you want to look away, you could look away now. You could hear a pin drop as everyone held their breath, and this perfectly delivered voice said, "Don't worry, he's not dead." I wanted the floor to open up and swallow me, but of course, years later, I can laugh telling the story. Please, can you apologise to all those at the Centertainment Complex in Sheffield whose enjoyment might have been spoiled by my six-year-old?
Excellent.
So there you go, that's the way it goes. And I hope that hasn't spoilt your enjoyment of anyone who's reading the book at the moment or is going to watch the DVD.
He's not dead yet.
We mentioned Jason Isaacs earlier, so hello to Jason. I must say, saying hello to David Morrissey is becoming a little bit stretched because Sky are promoting this Thorne detective series, the Mark Billingham book, so much that I pass about six posters with David Morrissey on every morning on the way, on the way taking the kids to school. So we all have to say hello to him every time we go past him. Which kind of it's quite fun, but everyone thinks you've just completely lost it. But it does extend, of course, now to posters, all film and TV, where any of these characters turn up. Just a quick word here from Phil, MNG, PhD, SNG, MKME.
But not ink.com.
No. Dear Dr. No and Dr. Parnassus, radio silence as I type this from a KLM Airbus en route from Malaysia to Amsterdam.
Wow.
So perhaps I will hear this via a cast pod somewhere in the future. The selection of latest movies on the in-flight menu didn't thrill me, so I flicked to the classics section.
Yeah.
Surely I'd be able to while away the next 12 hours with Citizen Kane, The Exorcist, or even Dougal and the Blue Cat. Shame on you, Phil. But no, classics, according to KLM, include... Let me pass you the list, which is helpfully photographed. Read out that list, Dr. K.
OK, the classics list. Ice Age, Dawn of the Dinos, In Bruges, La Boheme, Marley and Me on four channels. Night at the Museum 2 on three channels.
Phil says, God help us all. KLM should be thoroughly ashamed of themselves.
That is, it's the old joke, but isn't it? I walked in the last screening of yours, I saw I walked out and I was on a plane.
That's the classics list. What else is new?
Easy A, which is a smart, very funny teen comedy inspired in equal measure by Nathaniel Hawthorne's Scarlet Letter and John Hughes. So Emma Stone is a smart, slightly sort of awkward, nerdy, goth, outcast heroine about whom rumours circulate that she has had sex. She hasn't, but once the story is out, it's all around the school. Oh, you know, this has happened, blah, blah, blah. And immediately it falls into that thing that you've got to be one thing or another. You've either got to be, you know, completely uptight, or you've got to be a slut. Then what happens is her gay friend says to her, look, you know, since everybody thinks that that's what you are anyway, would you mind pretending to have had a ding-dong with me? Because then it will make people think that I'm straight, and then I will be accepted by the jocks. So she says, I don't want to do that. But then she realises that actually she can help him out. So she does pretend. And the next thing you know, this whole thing snowballs. And the story is about somebody who agrees to pretend to have been with several boys because the boys want... The boys need to have demonstrated that this is what they have done, whereas she, meanwhile, becomes increasingly isolated by the rest of the school, who all believe that she is behaving in a way which oddly mirrors the plot of The Scarlet Letter, a point emphasised by the fact that she starts wearing on her clothes a scarlet letter. Here's a clip.
The rumours of my promiscuity have been greatly exaggerated. I used to be anonymous, invisible to the opposite sex. If Google Earth were a guy, he couldn't find me if I was dressed up as a 10-story building. Pretty cutting-edge stuff, huh? A high school girl feeling anonymous. Who am I? What does it all mean? Why am I here? Blah. But don't worry. This isn't one of those tales.
What it is, however, is, as I said, smartly written teen comedy that has at its centre a, you know, very engaging, sort of a perky, intelligent, wisecracking performance in which the central character is somebody who's on whose side you are completely, because she's smart, because she's intelligent, because she's good-hearted, and because the ostracization that happens to her happens for all the wrong reasons, but in a way that is dramatically funny. It's a very good performance. There are loads and loads of references to John Hughes movie. One thing she talks about is, why isn't my life like a John Hughes movie, including the completely out of context musical sequence. And during the course of the film, obviously, there are ways contrived to make the John Hughes references. In fact, at one point they do that clip in which they start playing Don't You Forget About Me, and I actually started welling up it's lovely. It's kind of, there is that touch in it. Why isn't life more like a John Hughes movie? At least why isn't, well, of course, you know, for people,
do you often cry to Simple Minds?
No, I don't like Simple Minds very much, but it was the context of Simple Minds within the context of the John Hughes film. The other thing about it is that it has, you know, there's been an awful lot in the sort of in the post-Twilight world about the pressures that are on teenagers in terms of the way one should or shouldn't behave in terms of sexuality. This is a film which deals with those issues, does it with very sort of broad mind, but does it in a way which is, again, solidly behind independence, behind the idea that your decisions are your decisions, and the, you know, it is your right to choose, and it is your right to be the person that you want to be, and... it's about dealing with peer pressures in a way that, for example, a movie like Mean Girls would do, you know, very sort of nicely skewering all those, you know, the horrible social interactions that happen at school, the way in which when you're at school, people can be really mean-spirited to each other in more so than anywhere else, you know, out in life. But the best thing about it is it's funny and vibrant, and I laughed all the way through. There's a couple of lovely performances. Her father is played by Stanley Tucci, who is rapidly turning into being the person you would most want as your father, because he does, you know, and your screen father, he does screen fathers really, really well. The script is written sharply. It's obviously been properly edited. The film is made with the minimum of self-indulgence, even as it moves into its later stages. And we start to realise that there are certain sort of John Hughes tropes that they will have to repeat, even as they do them in a way which is completely knowing and understanding and isn't, I mean, yes, it stretches the bounds of credibility, but it's like when you get to that bit in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, when he gets up on the, you know, on the float and does the shout sequence. It doesn't matter, you forgive it everything because it's Ferris Bueller's Day Off. It's a really smart 15 certificate, intelligent teen comedy with its heart in the right place and a very good central performance and thoroughly enjoyable.
Pork Chop Express.
Yes.
This is from the blog where people have names like that. Adds this rather controversially, so we take making this. You must not clap at the end of a film. He's also said no horseplay, which he thinks is like a catch-all term. You must stay till the end of the credits. You must not clap at the end of the film, as the people who made the film can't hear you. This has just happened to me twice in Sheffield.
I quite like applauding the end of movies.
In Sheffield, where I saw the full Monty, I think people just clapped because they recognised places that they knew.
Yeah.
And in Spain, where I saw The Passion of the Christ, I'm not sure why they clapped, maybe because they just really like Jesus, says Pork Chop Express. But I think that's right. The first time I encountered that was... I'm just trying to think when it was the end of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest at Film Sock, Warwick University, and everyone knows that the cast and director aren't there, but it's just a spontaneous act. If you've had a fantastic time, you clap.
I have no problem with clapping at the end of a movie. Also, I mean, bear in mind, movies used to end with the national anthem, which you were meant to stand during the national anthem, and I'm not sure that, you know...
There's that fantastic episode of Dad's Army where that happens. So this is a 60s sitcom.
That's right.
And Captain Marion gets trampled as everyone...
He comes up with his glasses all sideways.
Is there another movie that we...
Yeah, there are. There's a few. Actually, let me just romp through a few.
How many do you think you can get through in 6 minutes?
Well, I'll do this quickly because, you know, it's half-term is up, so suddenly we have, you know, Digimations, animations everywhere. So Legends of the Guardians, The Owls of Gahul... That's fair. They didn't think that title through. Legends of the Guardians, The Owls of Gahul. Gahul.
Have there been other Legends of the Guardians that I've missed? That implies as though there have been others.
Yeah, I don't know. I've been to Paradise, but I've never been to Gahul.
And is there an apostrophe between the Ga and the...
There is, yes, the Gahul. There is. But anyway, so Legends of the Guardians, directed by Zack Snyder. Hey, Zack Snyder, Zack Snyder, Zack Snyder, Zack Snyder, Zack Snyder. 300 Watchmen. Zack Snyder, who is with the best... Zack Snyder, with the best will in the world. I can't stop doing that. With the best will in the world, not the world's greatest storyteller. So the story, it's like sub-Star Wars, post-Potter, Lord of the Rings-like, wannabe, watership-down, mythical, anthropomorphic, mythological story with owls. Okay? Beginning of the film...
Are they the owls of...
They are the owls... No, they're not the owls of Gahul, because they have to go... But they have to go find the legends.
Well, which owls are they, then?
Well, they're owls, but then the guy, I think, because they have to... Okay, look, two owls, right, at the beginning, get...
Ordinary owls?
Right. Wait, yeah, ordinary owls, get captured by Nazi owls, right?
Are they the owls of Gahul?
No, wait. Nazi Aryan owls, led by Helen Mirren, incidentally, and two brothers, right? They say, I either fight for the Nazi Aryan owl, who are taught, they want to stamp out all the mudbloods. Sorry, that's Harry Potter. And the other one gets sent off to the end of the mine because he doesn't want to stamp out the mudbloods. But then they have to go and get the guardians, who I think are the owls of... I kind of got lost, to be honest with you.
Do the knights who say ni? Do they turn up?
No, the knights who say gahu turn up. But it is, it's like, it's, you know, 3D digimation, and some of the animation is very well done. Some of the sweeping flight things are very well done. But here's the key to it. Firstly, Zack Snyder, Zack Snyder, Zack Snyder, Zack Snyder. Doesn't do great storytelling. And you do spend a lot of it going, what, eh, pardon? When they explain the thing about what the owls who aren't going to be soldiers have to do is to go through the regurgitated remains of rodents looking for strange bits of metal that might in somehow be used to turn the Nazi owls into the Aryan super race. And you're going, what, eh? And then there's more flying. But the biggest problem with it is I was sitting there going, look, wow, the animation on that feather is incredible. The way the wind is ruffling through that feather is incredible. And as the makers of Toy Story always said, the minute you start recognising that the animation is really clever, it means that the story's not working. And believe me, I spent a lot of time going, blimey, that's very good animated feathers, which means that the story wasn't working. It seemed terribly long. Also...
Can I just mention George on this email from Bahrain, who's kind of going along pretty much with you. Two parts Star Wars, one part Avatar, right. Two parts Mad Max, and three parts Springwatch.
Oh,
which you'd like to add in.
Yes, but no Bill Oddie. Alpha and Omega, memory of Dennis Hopper. Two packs of wolves, warring wolves, marriage between the wolves will sort out the warring between the wolves. Alpha wolves, Omega wolves. Alpha
are
and
the wolves of Gahul?
They're not the wolves of Gahul, no. They
should meet the owls of Gahul.
The Alpha and Omegas of Gahul should meet the... Anyway, so two packs of wolves, right? Has to be a central marriage. Problem is, Alpha wolf actually kind of likes the Omega wolf. Other Alpha wolves come out to me. Then two of them get kidnapped. Snapped and taken off to another part, then they have to make their way back, and then they have to once again. Innocuous, not very interesting story you've seen a million times. You've seen, you know, it's kind of Lion King light, and it's nothing but in its defense, there's nothing that's particularly problematic in it, and it has musical howling sequences. I mean, the central motif in it is can the wolves learn to howl in Gahul, and that's the howling turns into musical numbers, sort of like so. It's not very good. The other animation that's out this week is this thing, Mary and Max. And have you seen clips of this? There have been quite a few clips.
No, could you play me one?
No, I can't. Okay. I haven't got enough time. Mary and Max, an Australian animation, stop motion animation. Mary is a young girl who lives with her alcoholic mother. She's kind of alone. She's got a strange take on the world. Max is an anxious... very obsessive guy living in New York. She writes to him, having found his name in the phone book and asks him a bunch of questions about what life is like in America. And he, being the oddball, strange, misfit character that he is, writes back to her. And they begin this long-distance letter-writing relationship based on a strangely obsessive and offbeat and odd take on the world. The animation is really beautifully done. It's a stop-motion animation. It's really, I mean, it's a joy to behold. There is quite a lot of macabre humour in it. The film has got a 12 certificate. And in fact, if you go to the BBFC site, they explain why. I mean, there are many things in it. You know, there's death and strangeness and oddness and illness and alcoholism. And it's not, I have to say, you know, a fun for all the family kids movie. It is for a more mature audience. But if you think, for example, of the most macabre, most strange stuff that Tim Burton did, and then you forget all about that and then move on, it's kind of a step beyond that. Very, very fine voice performances, beautifully detailed animation, a strange, dark, twisted, you know, sideways look at the world. That was the main question for me was, who exactly is it for? And I tell you, it's not for very young kids, but it is for the young kid in the grown-up in all of us.
Which brings us to the final question, the movie of the week.
Easy A.
And for everyone else?
Easy A.
Easy A is the film of the week. Thank you very much indeed for listening. Keep the code of conduct emails coming. The discussion continues on the website. We're going to compile it into an all-consuming list.
And enjoy, parent. Boo.
Well, that's it for another week. Boy, that was fun.
You were particularly good this week.
Thanks, I was, actually. Sorry, I should have said, but in comparison with your good self...
Yes.
I really don't think I was anything compared with your genius.
I've been thinking, you know that Paranormal Activity 2 thing? I think that they should have made the theme tune for it, Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go.
If you'd like to contribute to our codes of conduct conversation, we are going to be, as we've mentioned during the programme, we're going to compile the definitive list. And then we're going to put it online, and then you can cut it out and keep it and actually fold it and put it in your wallet next to your kidney donor card.
And take it to your local cinema and nail it up against the wall like Martin Luther nailing his thesis to the church in Wittenberg. Was it 33, wasn't it?
39, was it?
39?
39.
The 39 steps.
No, it's 39 articles.
39, yeah.
But how many did he nail to the door?
Well, probably 39. Unless he put, and any other suggestions, and people put things underneath like, oh, church and state, separate.
That's quite enough of this. Oh, we could just go on for hours. Thank you very much, Steve, for listening. Download us again in a fortnight.
On digital and online. This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Kermode and Mayo's film review.
Hello, me again. To watch my latest reviews, take a trip to www.bbc.co.uk/Mark Kermode for the Kermode Uncut blog.